Welcome to the Sunflower Conversations, where we explore the hidden disability sunflower and its role in supporting people with hidden disabilities.
Hi, I'm Chantelle, and joining me on the Sunflower Conversations today is Russell Fleming from the ME Association to talk about ME and chronic fatigue syndromes. Russell has lived experience as well as being an employee at the ME Association. So hi, Russell, thanks for joining me today. How are you?
Thanks for having me. I'm very well, thank you.
So let's just start off. Can you tell us the main symptoms of ME and CFS and how debilitating is it?
So myalgic encephalopathy or myalgic encephalomyelitis, there's two sort of main names for it, is also known as chronic fatigue syndrome. And chronic fatigue syndrome doesn't really do it justice because it focuses on chronic fatigue when there are a lot of other symptoms present, and patients tend not to like CFS for those reasons. It's rather like if you call dementia chronic forgetfulness syndrome, it doesn't really do it justice. At the end of 2021, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, or NICE, published a clinical guideline on ME/CFS. We fully support the recommendations in the guideline, and it provides a framework to the NHS and to social care services on how they should diagnose and look after people with the condition. So the four main symptoms for suspecting ME are debilitating fatigue that is worsened by activity, post-exertional malaise after activity, in which the worsening of symptoms is often delayed by hours or days, unrefreshing sleep or sleep disturbance or both, cognitive difficulties, which are sometimes described as brain fog. There's also other symptoms that can affect a person's ability to function normally, and it can affect people very severely. So people with very severe ME tend to be bedbound all day. They don't have the energy to get out of bed. They're dependent on care 24 hours a day. They will need help, personal hygiene and eating. They can be very sensitive to external stimulations, so noise, light in particular. Some people may not even be able to swallow, and they may need to be tube fed.
That's very debilitating.
It is. And, you know, people in that condition can literally waste away in front of their friends and family's eyes. Severe ME, people may be able to carry out minimum tasks only, such as facial washing or cleaning of teeth. They're likely to have severe cognitive problems, and they may depend on a wheelchair to get around. They're often unable to leave the house, or if they do, then they suffer a prolonged after effect. They may also spend a lot of time in bed, and again, they're extremely sensitive to light and sound. And then you have people who are moderately affected. So we've gone from being unable to do pretty much anything for yourself if you're very severely affected, through to severely affected. Now we're moderately affected. People with moderate ME will have, again, reduced mobility, very restricted in anything they can do. So the normal sort of daily activities that healthy people would be able to manage, moderate people would not. However, they may well have peaks and troughs in their abilities throughout the day or throughout the week. They're still likely to have stopped work or be unable to attend school, college or university, and they will often need to rest in the afternoons. Again, sleep at night is generally poor and quite often disturbed. And then you have people who are mildly affected by ME, and it's a bit unfortunate that you know, we categorise them as having mild ME because it implies that it doesn't affect them to the same extent as others in as other people in the other categories, but it still has a big impact on their lives. And they may you may find people with mild ME are able to work or to go to school, college, or university. But a lot of the time it'll be on a part-time basis. And then when they come back from work, they'll be crashing out in their home lives, and they'll probably use the weekends to crash out as well, just to try and regain some of that lost energy so that they can go back to work in subsequent weeks. And then it still impacts their leisure and social activities. So you quite often find that they focus their limited energy in a particular direction, and then everything else around it sort of stops or is reduced. So that's more or less an overview of where we are with symptoms.
Well, that's the thing. Life is about balance. So if you're having to, as I said, all of your energy for your employment or education, then there's no balance, is there? There isn't room for the leisure activities that bring, you know, joy and are good for sort of your nourishment for your mental health. So it's a post-viral infection. We're not born with it, or is it something that's dormant in us?
So for the majority of people, they can trace the onset of their ME to an infection of some sort. And it can be any infection. From the most common is a viral infection. It's an Epstein-Barr virus, which is glandular fever to most people, or mononucleosis. And you tend to get that as a teenager. And that accounts for the largest onset, the biggest trigger. People simply, you know, unlike everybody else, a certain percentage of people just don't get back the health that they had before they got the virus. So that's what we mean by post-viral fatigue syndromes. And that then develops into a diagnosis of ME/CFS. At around the three-month mark. If people haven't gotten better, then they get diagnosed with ME/CFS ideally. And unfortunately, there's no specific treatments, there's no cure. It's a question of learning to live with the condition, which can mean having to make quite drastic changes to your life, to your lifestyle. But for other people, it's not, they can't figure out what might have triggered it. So there's still some uncertainty as to, you know, well, it seems to be infectiously triggered for most people. And we've seen it in a big array of different infectious triggers. So there's some sort of susceptibility in people, perhaps it's a genetic thing. We don't know, but it seems likely that the genes play a role. We also see within families that more than one family member can get ME.
That's so exactly, I was about to ask you that.
Yeah, so you can get a mum who has ME, and then children who develop ME. Again, we don't know if they're born with this susceptibility that they, you know, but it doesn't seem that both the mum and the children get it at the same time. Mm. We've also seen in families, in fact, one of our trustees at the charity, Nikki, her two children both got ME.
Really?
Yeah. So, and you're seeing it as well with long COVID, which we can come on to talk about a bit.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. So I've read that there are now more people with long COVID than ME.
Yeah, so the trouble with ME/CFS is that it's never been properly supported by the government or the NHS. And we really don't know how many people have ME. The research that has been done in this area has been I mean, some of it's been reasonably good, but it's not comprehensive enough. So, you know, we think that there's at least 250,000 people with ME or with the symptoms of ME in the UK. But that's a drop in the ocean, isn't it, when you're talking about 2 million people with long COVID.
Yes, yes. And the symptoms are basically the same?
Very similar. I mean, I'm looking at the Office for National Statistics' latest report on long COVID, which was February. And they were saying that about 1.8 million people had long COVID after a COVID infection 12 weeks ago or 12 weeks ago. So that seems, you know, a reasonable figure to use. But 1.8 million compared to 250,000 for ME, you can sort of understand why all the resource and effort has gone into better understanding long COVID. But what we're now finding, and I was at a big long COVID conference last week, we're now finding that long COVID researchers and clinicians are being more engaged with the ME community to try and learn from us, to because the management of long COVID is very similar, if not the same, as it is for ME. So it's all about activity management and pacing, learning to live with the condition. Mm-hmm. And research as well. They're now, or they have been, looking at the ME research to see if they can find similarities and differences with long COVID. And I think, as we said before this, before we started recording, I think more clinicians and researchers are coming round to thinking of long COVID as a post-infectious fatigue syndrome, which is what ME has always been classified as, a neurological illness, a disease that primarily affects the nervous system. But, you know, we've got to see where the research takes us. Interesting, you mentioned similar symptoms. So with long COVID, debilitating fatigue was the most common reported symptom, according to the ONS report. 71% of those who reported long COVID found that debilitating fatigue was their number one issue. And this was followed by difficulty concentrating, which is the cognitive problems that I referred to earlier as being one of the diagnostic symptoms of ME. And then it was shortness of breath and muscle ache. So muscle ache, again, the same as with ME. Shortness of breath, well, we know that COVID-19 particularly attacks the lungs. So we know shortness of breath is a consequence of having lung damage. So that's quite unique to COVID-19 when you compare it to ME and to other viral triggers. Other viruses also have unique aspects. So I don't think it excludes long COVID from being thought of as a post-viral fatigue syndrome. I just think that long COVID has more similarities with ME than it does differences.
I guess with COVID being a very sort of new and recent pandemic virus, it's still obviously in circulation. It's going to take some time before researchers and scientists are ready to kind of remove the separation and banner it under ME. Presumably there's so much more research to be done into that virus. And I guess as it mutates, as the each infection happens, the virus mutates a little bit. So do you not see that, like, the funding pot being kind of encompassing ME for a little while yet?
Yeah, I mean, it's another interesting thing to come out of recent research about long COVID is that about half of the people with long COVID do fit the criteria for ME-CFS. So if we're talking 2 million people with long COVID, then we could potentially be looking at 1 million people getting a diagnosis of ME at some point. So there's still this confusing area. I mean, I know personally that some GPs are now seeing people who they diagnose with long COVID who haven't got better after 2 years, and they are now re-diagnosing them with ME. Yeah. So I think there's a bit of confusion now, and I think the NHS need to, you know, lend some clarity to the diagnostic procedures.
You are listening to the Sunflower Conversations with Chantal. To share your story and find out more information, details are in the show notes. You said that there isn't a cure, and when you become ill, that's all you want to hear is what is the cure. So what are the clinical pathways for patients?
So the good news, I suppose, if you're lucky to have one, is that whether you've got a diagnosis of ME or you've got a diagnosis of long COVID, you should have access to an ME/CFS specialist service or a long COVID clinic. And these are both staffed by specialists who will be able to confirm your diagnosis and then help you learn how best to manage your condition. And they should be providing personalised advice based on your needs. And the NHS England have pumped millions into creating a network of long COVID clinics. And they did the same, but 20 odd years ago, to develop a network of ME/CFS specialist services. So the NICE guideline breaks down exactly what the referral route should be. And it also says who should be involved in your care at these specialist services, which are usually based at hospitals. You visit them as an outpatient. You'll have a number of sessions with them where they transfer their knowledge to you to help you manage your condition. Now, the new NICE guideline on ME/CFS, it's all about maintaining and continuing your healthcare, because what we were finding prior to the guideline was that people would get a referral to the specialist service. They'd be there for 6 weeks worth of sessions, say, if they could manage it, of course, and then they'd be discharged and then they wouldn't have any other care again. There was no follow-up. There was no continuity of care. But with the new NICE guideline in ME/CFS, it's very much about this tailored support, creating a care and support plan that is then shared with your GP and with social care services if you need them, to ensure that you remain part of the NHS, essentially, so that you should have this continuity of care and you shouldn't be just left to fight it alone. We've got a brilliant NICE guideline on ME/CFS. There's a lot of stuff in there. I recommend that anybody with ME really tries their best to read it or get somebody to read it on their behalf. But the NHS is in such a state at the moment that we're having great difficulty getting the recommendations implemented. So I think as a charity, we're going to be working with the NHS and social care services to get all the recommendations implemented across the whole of the UK for at least the next 5 to 10 years, because it's a huge, huge task. And the NHS is, you know, it's in a bit of a state at the moment, to say the least.
They need all of the support they can get to affect the changes, because you've already, you know, you've spoken about the symptoms, which sound painful, debilitating, isolating. So, you know, living with these conditions, you have ME, you live with it. You know, I don't know if you want to talk about your own personal experience or that of people that, you know, contact the ME Association. But what is it like?
For me, I've had ME for 23 years. And for me, I went abroad on holiday. I was living and working in Jersey. I was working for Lloyds Private Banking. I was an investment manager. Loved it. It was a 14-year career. It was brilliant. Had a great social life as well. Went on holiday abroad, picked up a nasty virus, was ill, came back into hospital. And for me, it felt like the virus never left, because my symptoms just continued. So, you know, even though the tests proved that the virus was no longer there,
right?
For me, it was like I was locked into this, to these symptoms, you know. And the symptoms were basically I couldn't function. I couldn't get back to where I was before. And so, like everybody else, I pushed myself. I tried to get back to work. I had several attempts at work. They didn't work out. And in the end, my parents had to come out to Jersey and pick me up and take me back here in Cornwall. And then followed six or seven years of me not accepting it. I refused to accept it. I wanted anything but ME.
Did they diagnose you with ME, after the 6 months, did they?
Yeah, so I got a diagnosis of post-viral fatigue syndrome at around 6 months, and then at 12 months, I think maybe I saw a different doctor or something, I can't remember, but he diagnosed me with ME. But at that time, 20 years ago, there was a lot of stigma. A lot of doctors, a lot of medics, a lot of media were all, labelling ME as yuppie flu. And of course, I was working in finance and I was dealing stocks and shares. And anyway.
Well, that would be part of the reason why you didn't want to accept it, right?
Yeah.
The stigma. Yeah. Which
but also because, as you know, with your work, having a largely invisible condition, I mean, the only thing that people could see was how it was affecting me. They couldn't, take a view inside my body to see it for themselves any more than I could. But, the number of times I remember wishing for broken legs or broken bones so that people could just see what I was feeling.
Compassion. Give you some compassion.
Yeah. Well, it was just because I got fed up people asking me how I was feeling and trying to describe what it was like. And my descriptions were never enough. Do you know what I mean? And especially when all the headlines were yuppie flu, it's not real, it's all in the mind. And you see, it was awful. It was awful. Yeah. And I will say that particularly with the new NICE guideline, but in general, I think we've turned the corner at long last on all that rubbish. Especially with long COVID, I think long COVID's helped too. Although at the conference I attended last week, some of the clinicians were still, and the researchers were still not happy with some of their colleagues who were still trying to psychologize long COVID when they knew damn well that it was, it was very real.
Yes.
So for about 6-7 years, I really struggled, and I struggled mentally. It really affected, I lost all confidence.
Is that the biggest battle, your mental health with it?
This is it. I'm not sure. I liked to think at the time that if the diagnosis had been something else, I might have coped better mentally.
Yeah.
At one point early on, they were convinced it was a brain tumour. And while that was upsetting in and of itself, I could cling to it. It was evidence of something.
Yeah.
So I think the hardest part for me, and it's not necessarily the same for everybody else, we're all different after all, but yeah, one of the hardest parts for me was the mental health side of it, because depression and things like that were totally new experiences to me.
Yeah.
And I attempted to take my own life at one point, and dealing with psychiatrists and people like that, and all they would say was, well, you've got to pull yourself together and you're obviously not trying hard enough. And
gosh.
I mean, it's appalling.
I hope these therapists are not like that anymore.
No, I mean, some of the therapists today, they hear the, examples of what it used to be like for people with ME, and they shake, they can't believe their profession was like that. And it's the same with long COVID, unfortunately. I think long COVID's showing up some good practices in the NHS.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also highlighting some of the remaining bad practices, unfortunately. So over time, things improved. One of the best things I did actually was when I was well enough. Because MEs, for a lot of people, it can be a fluctuating condition. But most of us, I'd say, spend you know, the first months at least, or years in my case and in other people's cases, at the sort of severe level where we can't do very much. So that's the biggest challenge to mental health. And then hopefully, and again, this unfortunately doesn't happen for everybody, you'll find things, you know, that the swings in severity of your symptoms will sort of stabilise. And then it provides you a bit of a foundation on which you can stand, not stand literally, and then hopefully things will slowly improve over, again, over a period. And it's all relative, you know, it's all relative to the individual, to what I was able to do yesterday, to what I was able to do last month. So eventually I went to part-time college, and it was great because it gave me some structure, and mum and dad used to drive me back and forth. And then I did that, and then I went to university in Wales. And again, because I thought it, you know, it would give me some structure, and it was a degree that I was really quite interested in, ancient history. And it wasn't something, there was no pressure on me to perform. It wasn't like it was, you know, I wasn't 18. It wasn't like, I need to get a degree to get a job. You know, it was quite relaxed. I was an adult. I approached it differently. But it had its own challenges. And, you know, I got infected by other flipping viruses from all these germ-ridden children.
They are the most unhealthiest places, aren't they? Places of education.
Oh, was it fresh as flu? Oh, nightmare. So anyway, so that was a good experience for me, and I heartily recommend it to anybody. Adult, going back to university as an adult is completely different. Anyway, so that was quite good. But I had some relapses, as I said, and then I tried to attempt work again. But even though I was applying for jobs that were well below my qualifications and my skills, I couldn't manage them. I remember being, I was on the night staff at Asda, because I thought working nights would be a bit less onerous, but that was a nightmare. My God, it's like slave labour. Don't know how anybody does it. Let alone somebody with ME, so that didn't last long. And then I was...
quite a physical job, I should imagine, isn't it?
Yeah, my God, it's like piecework, isn't it? It's like, why haven't you done that? I was like, God almighty, leave me alone. Anyway, and then I was admin assistant at special needs school, which I really enjoyed. It was really good, that. And but again, I couldn't do it. I remember one of the duties I had was to count the dinner money every day. Do you know what? I could not get the totals right, and it was driving the others in the office absolutely mad, because they had to recount everything I did.
But you were an investment banker, so it's not like you were the numbers.
I know. So that was another thing, trying to deal with that. I mean, God, talk about embarrassing. I started boosting my online presence a bit, and teamed up with a few people that I've got to know who also had ME, and we started covering the science, and we started tweeting, and then we helped create a forum. So that was quite interesting diversion, because I'm not a scientist at all by background, but it was quite interesting to work with other people who understood the science a bit. Mm. And we were all patients as well, so that was good. And it got us involved with some of the researchers, and you know, we were able to blog about them and try and raise the profile of ME research a bit better, which we did. That was great. And then the ME Association got in touch and asked me to produce a few reports for them, which I did. And then that led to a part-time role as website and social media manager. And then that went into communications manager, and now head of communications, working full time from home.
Congratulations. That's
quite
a journey you've been on in those last 23 years.
Yeah, ups and downs. But it is all relative, isn't it? Because I can sit here and I can look back on it. And funnily enough, that I think 2 years ago, I wrote an article, Surviving ME. And I said on the last podcast I was on, if I'd written an article 10 years before that one, it would have been totally different, because it would have been all about struggling and, you know. So it's all about perspective, isn't it? And relativity. I mean, if I wrote something today, I can talk in all honesty about, you know, improvements and stability of symptoms. I still have a fantastic support network around me so that I can focus all my energy on work, which is what I've chosen to do. And I couldn't work if it wasn't for them.
You have presumably flexible working conditions. You work in the mornings, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I still struggle massively with bad sleep. I don't know anything about it, but just completely flummoxes me. Even after all these years, I haven't figured out a way of doing it properly. So the most I can sleep is 4 hours if I'm lucky, but yeah, invariably it's 1 or 2 hours. And what I've learned over the years, I suppose, is that I just don't keep tossing and turning. I just get up and get going. So inevitably, I usually start work in the early hours and then finish around lunchtime. But I take a break or two in between, you know.
Do you sleep in the afternoon, Russell?
Yeah. In fact, my afternoon sleeps are quite often the best sleeps. That's the biggest chance I've got of having some uninterrupted sleep. But I have epilepsy as well.
Okay, and that's a result of ME.
Yeah, so that was diagnosed after the diagnosis of ME, because I was having these seizures. And but touch wood, that's the one thing that with medication it's reduced the frequency, and I don't get them half as often as I used to, but now they tend to hit me at night. But there's other things about nighttime disturbances, as I refer to them. You know, you get these awful night sweats and the terrible nightmares, and I used to get, thankfully don't get it anymore, something called hypnagogia. And it's a paralysis that occurs just as you're waking or just as you fall into sleep. Mm-hmm. And you don't know that you're still in sleep mode. You think you're awake, and it can lead to hallucinations. And I used to get these hallucinations of giant insects in my room. Oh, it was weird, absolutely weird.
Do you think that was related to any medication that you were prescribed?
Or I don't know. It went on for so many years, though.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a weird, but like last night, couldn't sleep last night. All I could do, and this happens quite a lot, is it felt like I wasn't dreaming. It felt like I was just thinking. I had my eyes shut. I was just thinking away. I wasn't stressing. I was just pondering things.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get into deep sleep. And that's the problem. I can't get into deep sleep and stay there.
That's insomnia is torture.
Oh, it's funny, though. It's not funny. But this is a thing with ME. You're either sleeping too much or you're sleeping too little. There doesn't seem to be it's either or. There's no sort of compromise in between. Usually in the early years or the early months or the early years or when you're having a relapse, your body is needing you to sleep a lot longer. And then when you're sort of more stable and maybe you've experienced some improvements, in my experience anyway, you seem to have switched from too much to too little.
It's when you're working, you're connected to people as well, aren't you? Mm. It's a connection. It's not so isolating and with only one thing to think about, which is your condition, health.
It's true. I mean, work is it's completely given me... I've always gravitated towards things that give me purpose. So going, you know, when I was ill and disabled, going to college, going to university, trying to find jobs that were the right fit, setting up the forum, doing all the research studies, things that would take me out of myself. And I think that's an important part of acceptance, isn't it? And trying to motivate, because nobody wants to be unable to sleep and worrying about how ill they are. nobody wants to be sick in bed worrying about how old we are. Sometimes it's unavoidable.
Yeah.
But if you can find these distractions, let's call them distractions, I think it does unclog your brain, and you know, it's a relief to any mental health problems.
So what therapies are there? So if we talk about what's actually available now as opposed to what NICE say we should be providing patients, what therapies do exist?
Well, unfortunately, with it, again, it's often a question of trial and error. So in my early years, once I'd gotten over the acute phase, I spent an absolute fortune on any and all therapies and treatments that I could possibly find, because I was convinced there had to be something that would work. And of course, nothing did. And I was worse off for it. So if you go on the internet, there's a lot of people out there claiming that their product or therapy will provide a cure or will provide recovery. You know, and you really got to be careful. You know, you've got to try and approach these things objectively. Mm-hmm. You know, if anybody's out there offering a cure, then I'd say that they're talking out their backsides. If people are offering you a product or a therapy that hasn't been backed by sort of gold standard science, then I'd leave it alone. But sometimes, you know, both I and the chat, we don't judge people, because we've all been in this sort of desperate situation ourselves. But, you know, so if you find something that you think helps, I was reading, we're just publishing our magazine, and I was doing the editing this morning, and there's an article in there from a lady with long COVID who's found hyperbaric oxygen therapy to have been really helpful for her. And, you know, it's fine. It might not be for everybody. There's no scientific evidence that suggests it could be. But, you know, things of that nature, if people find, it doesn't even have to be therapies, does it? If people find that, you know, things they can do for themselves at home work or felt to help, then great. I think it's a question of finding something that works for you.
You are listening to the Sunflower Conversations with Chantal. To find out more about the topics discussed in this podcast, details are in the show notes.
Just thinking back to when you were at work and talking about your, you know, invisible disability, what do you think about the sunflower?
Oh yeah, so I mean, I think having a card to explain what your illness is very, very useful. We get asked a lot about, you know, do we as a charity provide lanyards? Because some people like wearing them on the bus and things like that, or the train. We always direct them to you. So I think if for people who want to be visible, it's great. Not everybody does. You know, some people don't want to be forced to explain what's wrong with them. They don't want to stand out from the crowd, I suppose. But for those that do, it's great.
And what support is the ME Association giving to people?
So the main service for support and information that we provide is called ME Connect. It's a 365-day-a-year telephone helpline, email and social media messaging service. During the pandemic, the calls to ME Connect and the use of the emails, etc., rose about 40% in the first year of the pandemic, and then another 40% in the second year of the pandemic. And the levels have held reasonably well since the pandemic. So we're talking about 5,000 to 6,000 people a year using the service, which is, you know, pretty good for a small charity of our size. We also provide the largest range of information, literature on post-viral fatigue syndrome, ME/CFS and long COVID. We have the most acknowledged expert on ME/CFS in Dr. Charles Shepherd as our medical advisor. He's supported in turn by a team of other specialist advisors, from benefits advisors to employment advisors, to dietitians. And we also operate, obviously, really good social media. We have engaging discussions, and you know, I think most people who use our social media find it very helpful. And then for members, we have ME Essential magazine. As I said, I was just putting the next one to bed this morning. And we produce ME Medical magazine, which goes out to healthcare professionals. At the tail end of last year, we sent some key information packs to every GP surgery in the whole of the UK, Channel Islands and Isle of Man. We're the only charity to have done that. It told them all about the NICE guideline, etc. It told them about the similarities and differences between ME and long COVID. And we got other things coming up in the pipeline. Christmas, just this Christmas, we were the only charity that didn't ask for donations. Instead, we asked our members to nominate their unpaid carers that support them. And then we sent hampers to randomly selected carers, which
seemed
to go down very, very well. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to do that again. Because carers are so busy caring, we don't hear enough from carers, and yeah, it can be hard to reach them sometimes. But it was a delight to see the photos of carers receiving the hampers and reading their stories. You know,
and you've said how important having a support structure is. So
yeah, and then finally, we're one of the few charities that invests directly in research. So, we review any grants from researchers wanting to look into ME/CFS or long COVID, and then we directly fund it. So we're supporting the UK ME/CFS Biobank at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and we've been doing that since 2011. Mm-hmm. We've just supported two studies by Nicola Clay Baker and her team of physios for ME, one of which they went out and they monitored the physical recordings of people in their own homes. So it was a way of trying to quantify. So if a person with ME at home isn't able to leave their bed or can only sit up in bed or can only walk for a certain few steps, etc., Nicola was able to go in and attach recording devices to them that monitored heart rate, that monitored breathing, that did all of that, so that we can try and quantify the actual effect that ME does have on people. That's quite interesting. And the second study, they're looking at using heart rate monitors to see if it's an effective way of pacing.
Right.
So, so they were quite good studies. And then we got a big campaign, hopefully going to start in May, which I can't say too much more about, but it's going to be a big attempt to try and reach more people. So, on Facebook, for example, we know we're followed regularly by about 30,000 people. We know that if we get, a really good post out, it can reach 250,000 or more people. But what we want to do is to try and get in touch with people who might have symptoms but don't yet have a diagnosis. We want to get in touch with more people with long COVID, mm-hmm. and we want to try and bring them to the charity so that they can benefit in terms of getting the right diagnosis, in terms of learning how best to manage their condition. So that's something we hope to launch in May.
Yes, quite a lot that you...
So, I don't know how I remember it all.
I know. You're not even reading off a list. finally, what do you recommend for anyone who's listening that has ME, CFS, and isn't sure where to seek advice? I mean, you've just said such a lot that you're doing, I would imagine.
One of the first things you can do is get in touch with ME Connect. So that's our support and information service. You can do it either via email, by sending us a private message on social media, or telephoning the helpline. Like I say, we're open 365 days a year. Make initial contact. We can put you in touch with local support groups. I think one of the best things is to get in touch with somebody else who's got the same condition or the same symptoms, because trying to cope alone is incredibly difficult. Obviously, if you're acutely affected, then I suggest that if any carers or family members or friends are listening, then they get in touch on their loved one's behalf. Because it might be too difficult for the affected person to do so. But make that initial contact with us, and we'll try and help you.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you very much for your time today, Russell.
Thank you, Chantal.
If you are interested in any of the advice discussed in this podcast, please follow up with your GP or healthcare practitioner.
If you'd like to share your sunflower story or conversation, please email conversations@hiddendisabilitiesstore.com. Find out more about us or listen to this recording again by checking out our insights page at hiddendisabilitiesstore.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and LinkedIn. Please help, have patience, and show kindness to others, and join us again soon. Making the invisible visible with the Hidden Disability Sunflower.